Accession number 17183, Roman halter, reel 3, followed after a pause by reel 4. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel informant and interviewer.
Roman halter, reel 3.
So eventually, when certain purchase parts of forest ended and my brother had to find some work to do, he really became apprentice to a watchmaker, but he found this quite boring. He used to bring certain parts and put them in a drawer and lock the drawer up. Once I found the key and opened this drawer and I found all these wonderful parts, and I was quite fascinated by him. But he came in, and being senior to me by so many years, he was then 38, he was 18, and 38, I was 9, he gave me a big hiding. I had no redress when I went to my father and mother and said I was beaten up by Icho. His name was Itzhak, and Itzhak's name was Icho. They said, you must have done something wrong, otherwise he wouldn't beat you up. Parents took an idea that if siblings were fighting, you only came in when you saw blood under the door, you know. So it didn't do me much harm, and I learned my lesson. I would never open his drawer again. My father felt that it was important for him to know what the members of the family are doing. So at lunchtime, the lunchtime was also a form of discussion of who did what. And I also had to give a report how I got on at school. And one day I said to my parents at the table, I don't think I want to go to the cheder anymore. And they said, why is that? That was going before school. So I said, because this teacher pinches me. Pinches you? So I said, yes. Each time a mistake, he pinches me, and I lowered my trousers and showed it to the family. I stood up on the chair, and I was blue, completely on the side. So my father looked at my mother looked at my father and said, you must be a very bad pupil, because those who don't make mistakes are not pinched. But I was taken out from there, and my grandfather started teaching me. But my grandfather was such a tolerant man that instead of teaching, we used to sit and eat pears and eat apples. And he would tell me stories, and we used to go for a walk and walk towards the lake. Some of the contemporaries of mine who belong to the 45H Society know certain Talmudic things much better than I do, and when it comes to prayers, you know, they know them off by heart. So I missed out on that, but I didn't have any more bruises. That was some compensation. The man who was the beadle in the mikvah was also the man who read the Torah I mentioned, and there's a tremendous skill of reading a Torah, because the people who are called up to read the Torah, and I don't know how it continues now, but there used to be a custom that the man who reads the Torah stands in the middle. The beadle who eventually reads the passage and reads it with a tremendous, what was called niggling, in other words, going up and down in voice, like, oh, what are you? Oh, in various ways like that, is quite a skill, because on top of these letters, which haven't got dots underneath, so it's very hard to know the Hebrew, there are also punctuation, whether your voice should go up, whether you should hold the tune before you read the next letter, and very few synagogues in this country know this. Only those who are properly taught and they go for a course to Jerusalem, to various synagogues, carry this through. And it sounds wonderful when it's read by someone with a melodic voice. But those who are called up to say the prayer before the reading of the passage. Were people who were not so learned, and the custom was that the beadle stood on one side of that man, and another person stood on another side, and when he, for instance, read Shema, and he held that too long, meant he didn't know how to read the next word, so it was whispered to him on one side. In case he was deaf in one ear, it was whispered to him on the other side, so he doesn't make the mistake, so the dignity of his person is maintained, so he doesn't fold in front of the other ones. But this whispering was quite accepted, but he then said it aloud, the next word, and went on, but he never stumbled. So some people knew it very well, others were helped in this discreet way. And this beadle, before coming to the end, which is the part, which is the mafter, which some person is called to read the last passage, would auction it, because the community had very little money, and one had to maintain the synagogue, and you were not allowed to mention money. So the sums were set in alphabetical order, and he would say, this great passage, you know, equivalent in Hebrew there, or Yiddish, this great passage at the very end goes for A, goes for A, goes for Aleph, you see, for A, and somebody would go like that, and he said, this great passage that is full of wisdom and so goes for B, goes for B, and eventually, if there was a custom, that if somebody not very wealthy bid for it, for B, those who had money did not go for C. They kept quiet. So he should not be outbid. So everybody should stand a chance of getting that. It's only on special holidays that it became more competitive for certain passages. But I was quite fascinated, and being naughty, sort of sitting, my father didn't notice, I used to raise my hand, and of course he would ignore children because it was not meant to be read by a child, but it was our form of a leg pull. And later on, when the service finished and the beadle stood outside, he would say, oh, you coochie-coochie, and pinch your cheek, but rather hard, so he knew you deserved it. The life went on like that, and not many people had a chance of emigrating, because although they had a cousin here, or cousin Bolivia, or cousin somewhere else, they felt that they were not certain what the world had outside. They have lived in Poland, they have weathered various adversities, and they thought that this screeching eventually will have to stop. Everybody thought Germany was such a civilized country compared to the barbarity of the Russians.
How bad had it got by about 1937-38, the screeching coming in?
Quite bad, quite bad. In fact, there were Jewish papers, and when they reported, the Jewish community was very sad, but they felt themselves trapped because they had no money, no means. They couldn't sell out and get passports going anywhere. In fact, the gates and all the doors were shut for them. And all they could hope was to pray and believe in God and believe also that one day this is going to stop.
How about your father, you know, your father and family? Was there any discussion that you were aware of about the situation?
Oh, yes. The discussion was right from 34 onwards that I can remember. But you must understand that when I was born, my father was 51, my mother was 31, 20 years difference. And my father felt that by 37, when I was 9, he was 60, that he had not enough up and go in him. And it took him so long to build up business, to leave everything behind, and to emigrate to Palestine, where the experiences came that my uncle, who went there, died, and the family were existing in great poverty, there was no way of going anywhere. People from large cities who had means managed to somehow get out. They went to Palestine or somewhere else, but nobody from our town, nobody from our community. And my father used to discuss this with Mr. Hoffmann, this German Pole, or Pole who was German. And Mr. Hoffmann said, "Ah, Mr. Halter, you find me all right. This is a bit of propaganda." But of course, how he felt, hoped inside, that eventually all the Germans who were in this part of Poland, which was really a German-speaking part of Poland, will be part of Greater Germany, he did not disclose. And so people existed. And what was more is that as the screeching became greater, those traders who went to other markets to trade and got up as early as Al Podlavsky with the timber had to travel in convoys. And the butcher's sons, who were strong, used to be at the back and also the strongest men in the front. Because there were many stories how they were robbed, the goods were taken away, how the women were raped. And this law, which exists among Jewish people, that the child of a Jewish mother is Jewish, whether he was conceived by a non-Jew, was wonderful, because many of the mothers who were raped and gave birth, there was no birth control, to a child, the child became Jewish. And if one compares it with today's existence, there was no comparison really, because life was very hard. If you went to a little trader shop, he had barrels of herring, and he had barrels of cabbage and barrels of cucumber, and he used to put these barrels on a cart, and with this horse that was all skin and bone, he used to travel to the next market and take down the barrels and sell a few cucumbers and a few herrings. And, you know, he would travel back, and that was his way of living, of making a living. The diet was really one main meal a day. But it didn't do people any harm, because, you know, to be slim and to be to have bones showing is fine. We are very much too fat nowadays. We eat too much. We eat too good a food. The air was fresh. There was no pollution. The life also in a little place like Hodge was wonderful from another point of view. There were forests. There was the lake. And after this Shabbat meal, when one had the cholet and one wasn't allowed to do anything on a Sabbath, one went for a walk. And one went round the lake and came back again to town and one's home. In our house, we're fortunate, there was a big oven and the place was warm during the winter. And my aunt, who was musical and she played the mandolin, and my uncle, who was the conductor of the Fire Brigade Orchestra, played the flute, and there was music, and there was singing, and then they played chess, and they had discussions, and I loved that. We used to put chestnuts in the oven, in the main sort of hole in the oven, and had these, and one put, I think, the news of the imminent danger aside, and life went on. But I'm sure it lingered in the back of all Jewish people, saying, is it going to be worse or is it going to be better? And the Polish government then, the way I understood it, was they were flirting so much with the German. They wanted to be accepted as part of the German nation. They wanted to do exactly what Hitler wanted them to do. It didn't work. There was a minister called Beck who was sent back and forth. And there was Ritz Schmigwe, who hoped dearly that Poland would be embraced by Germany. And when they found it really didn't work, there were slogans towards 39. Not only that we will not give our waistcoat to Germany, but not even a button will be given. And we have a cavalry that can stand up to any nation. Little did they know, poor people, that Germans were rearming and they had wonderful tanks and they were modernizing. And the Polish army stood absolutely no chance against Hitler's forces.
This wonderful Jewish life that you've described so well, you were saying only 4 out of the 800 survived. That would have gone.
Completely, yes. You see, there was also a cultural life. The rabbi decided there must be a library. So there was a library first full of Jewish books. And there were so many gifted Jewish writers of short stories that the paper which my father got, the Hind, after he finished reading the letters on Friday after the meal, he would read various amusing articles in the Hind in Yiddish and would sit there. And it was a wonderful sense of richness, of intellectual richness. One sat and after a meal and listened to that. And there was also a custom that when travelers were coming through the town, after the service on Friday, they lined up next to the rabbi, and certain families were obliged to invite them to meal and to stay overnight. So one shook hands with them, and my father said, "Fine, come with us." And they used to come, and they used to bring news of other places. And that was accepted, that you traveling was so hard that when a stranger came to town, he was embraced, and that was reciprocated again when certain families traveled to other places. And somehow they knew of people who were semi-related, or cousin, or second cousin, or third cousin, and they brought their stories from abroad. One heard about the world outside the world of Hodage. My mother was fairly modern, and she felt that in addition to this ritual bath, that the children should go to the lake during the summer. And she and her sister, my aunt, would go down and take us children. So I learned to swim at the age of 6, and I was very proud of it. And also, there were certain expeditions on a Sunday, because the store had to be closed. We weren't allowed to trade because Sunday, Shabbat was ours. So we used to go mushroom picking and picking wild strawberries. And when my father started prospering again, he bought some land. And my mother, who, because of her father being a state manager, knew more about land than my father did, so she looked after the land. And the man, Podlaski, used to get people to pick potatoes when it came to potato picking. We had also a woman called Mrs. Lewandowska who came to do the washing and helped out with various hard chores. And she was to me like a mother, because my mother lost her milk when I was something like 3 months, and she had a child that time too. So she was my milk mother. And even when I was 6, she used to have a child every sort of year and a half. She would feed her latest baby and would say, "Romek, do you want a swig of the breast?" And she was so well endowed that if I said, "No, thank you," and would blush, she would squirt the milk into my face. But I had a tremendous affection for her, because once she was the leader of potato pickers, and they used to pick in a sort of angle of 45 degrees. The leader was in front, and the other was followed. That was done in a way that no potatoes left behind. So if the first one left a potato behind, the next one picked it up. And they had these big baskets, and there was a big tarpaulin at the very edge of the field, and they used to empty that on a tarpaulin, and the cart came and loaded it up and took the potatoes away. And she was strong and firm and happy, and she was pregnant. Suddenly, she came back to the heap, and I was there sitting with other children by the potatoes. And she said to me, "Quickly, Romek, could you go and get the doctor?" Because she suddenly felt that she's going to have a child. So I ran home, and I said, "Podlaska asked me to get a doctor." So my mother said, "Yes, you have a child. Go quickly and tell him." By that time, we had a Jewish doctor who was very knowledgeable and sympathetic, because the previous Polish Christian doctor used to prescribe cod liver oil for every illness, and people with acute appendicitis were killed off. And the mayor, who was a German in our town, a very able man, was killed by this doctor. He was given cod liver oil, and he died. So I went to this Jewish doctor, and the Jewish doctor was just finishing his meal. And he said, "Lead the way with Podlaska lives." And she, with all her children, lived in a cottage which was whitewashed, immaculately clean. And when we came there, she was cleaning the doorsteps. So he said, "Where's Podlaska, who's just about to give birth?" So she said, "That's me. But since I know that you are coming, I couldn't leave the doorstep there." And she led him inside, and there was the next baby. And it was so natural for people there. You know, they squatted and gave birth, and they attended to themselves. So I was asked to wait outside whilst he examined her, and he went off back to his surgery. My mother would pay for the bill, and the next day she would come along, and my mother said, no, you go home, you go home, come back in a few days' time, you know, it's quite wrong. And she was firm, happy. I must skip quite a distance, because when I came to my town after the war, after surviving to Chodesh to find whether anybody was alive, she was there, and she welcomed me like a mother. And she said, "Stay with us, change your name to our name, and we'll go east. We are going to part of Germany now, that's going to be Poland." And she really was the one who was so very welcoming, and so was Podlaski, who worked for my father for 14 years. My father's first wife, my father had five children. The eldest one was Szlamek. These are the Polish names. Sala, then was Pecho, which is in Hebrew Pesach, Ruja, and Icho. Then my mother had two children, Zosia and myself. She was 6 years older, so my mother fell pregnant after she married, and then I came 6 years later. Szlamek was quite a strong character, and he wanted to be on his own. He didn't want to work with my father. So he first became a manager of a flour mill in Chodesz, and then he moved to Wrocławek, and he was manager of a plywood factory and also a sawmill. Pecho was a romantic, and he read quite a lot, various adventure books, book about Africa. And although I don't remember it very well, it was told in the family how he ran away. He wanted to go to Africa, and he traveled without tickets, and managed to reach almost the borders of Czechoslovakia, where he was caught, and my father had to go and bail him out, and he was brought back. So after this, he had to do something sensible, and he eventually became a manager of a textile factory in Lodz. Sala married, and she lived in Brześć Kujawski. And when I had my appendix out at the age of 6, 1933, I was whisked to Toruń just in time before I was prescribed cod liver oil. And I was there for quite a long time because I had an infection, and they thought I was going to die. The surgeons were not very good. They sort of butchered me about, and everybody in the family thought that because I had matter oozing out from the wounds, that eventually I would die from the infection. But one day I got up and I was all right. Whilst I was there, Sala's first child was born, and she lived in Brzeszkujawski with Gershon, her husband. He was a maker of leather goods, especially uppers for shoes. And I found it always very interesting when I was taken there, because I could make the pouches for catapults from the leathers left over. And he was belonged to a Zionist group, and he was one of the leaders of a Zionist organization, Brzeszkujawski. That is Szlamek, Pecho, and Sala. Ruzia lived with us, and she had an accident on the lake. She was drowning, and then she was saved in the last minute. Her friend died. They were in a kayak, which turned over, and the fishermen, who had rights to fish in the lake, managed to get there, and as she bobbed out from underneath the depths, he caught her hair and pulled her out, but the other friend drowned. I don't know whether it was the shock or something else, but she died a year later, and she developed a cough, and I think it wasn't quite certain what happened, whether she had cancer and said that she swallowed quite a lot of mud, or whether she had something, which was beyond me. The doctor couldn't quite diagnose, and it was a very sad thing, because my father insisted that she should take milk, butter, and honey that would cure her. You know, these primitive cures. And the doctor said, I really don't know what to prescribe. And my father was very strict with her. And I remember when I brought her this milk, honey, she used to skim that off and put it in the mattress, because we had straw mattresses. I kept the secret, but and my father used to come up and said, have you drunk it? So she said, yes, but she could not take the creamy stuff on that made her sick, really. And so quite a lesson how members of the family behave to one another. Icho became a watchmaker, and he went to live in Włocławek. Zosia, at the beginning, before the war broke out, finished the school, couldn't get into university, and she became a corset maker. She also was apprenticed in Włocławek. And then she came home, and I was fascinated by all this fantastic contraption that she made. And very stout ladies to come for being measured for it and being strapped into it. They came fed and walked out slim. With all the fish bones stuck into it and all the other parts. For me, all this was of great interest, and I felt that when I saw Gershon Brzeszkujawski, I wanted to be an upper maker of leather. When I saw her, I wanted to be a corset maker. When Icho talked about watchmaking, I thought I could be a brilliant watchmaker. I was everything, sort of a Walter Mitty in all these trades. Then this friend of my father, Mr. Hoffman, figured quite large when the Germans came in. And the war broke out. And as soon as it broke out, the Polish government took all the Germans from our town, not all of them, but the main leaders, and they marched them. And they marched them out from Chodecz in direction of Kowo. And then they marched them back again. 4 days later, they came back all disheveled. Not 4 days, it was 2 days later or so. All disheveled, looking terribly worn. And they were lined up, and some of the Polish people in the town were spitting on them. You traitors, you so and so. And my mother said to me, here's a bucket of water. these people are thirsty, and go and give it to them. There's Mr. Hoffman, there's so-and-so. So I went out, and the guard who guarded them, the soldier, shushed me away and sort of kicked me. I said, "Don't you dare! My mother asked me to give them water." So I gave water to Mr. Hoffman, to these people. Because after all, we grew up amongst them. And the soldier wanted to kick me. I said, "I'm going to kick you if you are going to do this." I was totally fearless about it. So he felt, "Oh, I'll let him." So these people were so thirsty, and they drank this water. And they said, "Can you bring us some bread? Can you bring us some this?" So I went in and got this for them, told my mother, and whatever she had, she sent me out and gave it to them. And of course, a day later or 2 days later, they came back, and the Germans were already there, you see. And the first ones to be shot were the people who spat on them, of course. And very soon afterwards, when the Germans came in, all the leaders, Jewish,